In our study this morning, I once again express my gratitude to Richard for teaching the class Wednesday night. And I understand that you talked about the top of page 75, somewhat detailed, with Joshua's challenge to the people to choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of the fathers that are beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah. The people very confidently affirm their faith and trust in God, who brought them up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Again, they are aware of the deliverance of God, that He has provided for them this new land. He has provided for them the land of the Amorites. And Joshua calls upon them to be their own witnesses to the decision that they have made, that they will be faithful in their discharging duties unto God, and they affirm that they are witnesses and they will be faithful to God. I think sometimes when we make statements that at the time we make those statements, we're fully confident that that's what we desire and that's what we intend to do. I think when we look into the New Testament and Jesus says unto the disciples that you will all forsake me, and the Apostle Peter said, no, not me, I will die first. I think Peter very confidently believed that that would be his decision. And when he drew his sword to strike off, I believe, the head of Malchus, the high priest's servant, striking off his ear, we see Peter's willingness to defend the Lord, even if it meant his own death, and I think that's commendable. But it was later, when Peter was identified as one of the disciples of the Lord, that he denied the Lord three times, just as the Lord had told him that he would do. When these people confidently affirm, we will serve the Lord, we'll be faithful to Him, we know what He's done, and they have seen His power, His might, His provisions, and when they vow their faithfulness to Him, I'm confident, at least at the time they said it, that they meant that to be true. But as we come to the period of the judges, we see that there is a different reaction on behalf of these people. And what has essentially changed from the time that this commitment is made till the time that we read about them worshiping and serving idols? Randy? Another generation has come on the scene. They didn't teach them. Now, the passages that you studied Wednesday night, as you talked about Deuteronomy chapter 7, what was it that Moses had commanded them not to do? Do not marry into the heathen nations that are there. Now, that was not what they did. They went in and they conquered them, but they didn't either kill them all or drive them out. They left some of the inhabitants in the land. And God then was not quick to drive the inhabitants out. Why? All right, because of the people's sins. They did not seem to be committed to the end that they should be to drive the people out. And I marked a passage, and I can't put my finger on it right now, where God said that He didn't want the land to be overtaken with the animals that were in the land. Where is that? That's a Joshua passage. No, that is a Deuteronomy passage, chapter 7. Thank you. That's correct, Randy. You're right. Deuteronomy chapter 7. That's why I was failing to find it. Yes. Yes, there's my mark. It says in verse 22, "And Jehovah thy God will cast out those nations before thee by little and little. Thou mayest not consume them at once, lest the beast of the field increase upon thee." But yet we do see that though there were some left in the land, these became a snare unto the children of Israel, and they did not utterly drive them out. And there were consequences that ensued. Now, you've studied and we've talked about the text of Joshua chapter 11, where Joshua came in and the land has been taken. We talked about Joshua chapter 23, where not one thing has failed. And we also talked about the warning that Joshua gave unto them. When we think of these warnings, I want you to think in concert of the warnings of Moses and Joshua. Moses warned them in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 25, beginning, where he told them long before they came into the promised land that if you worship and serve other gods, what's going to happen to you? All right, you'll be cursed. That's right. And in Deuteronomy chapter 8, again, if you worship and serve other gods, what's going to happen to you? All right, he'll drive you out. That's right. And then in Deuteronomy 28 through 30, those chapters, God assures them of the blessings and the curses. And then in chapter 30, when you return, there'll be a remnant that will be restored to the land. When you keep the commandments, statutes, and ordinances that are written in the book of this law, which indicates that the period of the restoration would be implemented upon their return to the law of Moses. Now, we know that there's not going to be yet a future restoration because the law of Moses has been nailed to the cross, done away, etc., etc. But we want to be reminded of these things in conjunction with what Joshua has said to them in Joshua chapter 21, verse 45, and Joshua chapter 23, beginning in verse 14 through verse 16. Now, as time transpires, we come to lesson 19, and of course I'll simply on this chart identify that the period of the judges lasted about 300 years. And what happened during that 300 year period? They went around and around the horn through 15 different judges. What was the cycle of their rebellion? And we're going to talk about these individually. You have these listed in your lesson book, I believe, and we'll talk about these as we come to them in the chapters that you see listed on the board. But this circle that they make does more than just indicate initial intention. Randy? Tell me what the circle is. All right. That's it exactly. Let me get back to my circle. Where is it? Well, I've got it. I put it in there, I know. I want to look here at this point. When we think of this 300-year period, it's easy perhaps for us to think of a shorter period of time and see rebellion on behalf of the children of Israel. But expanded over a period of time, as you have illustrated with the circle, it seems that the people become indifferent. They become apathetic, lazy, as it were, toward the commitment that's been made. Plus, you have the factor of generations passing, a lack of teaching on behalf of the children. And when they did not completely drive out those who inhabited the land, it appears that they tolerated their idolatrous worship. But then they began to play with that themselves, experiment with it, as we have on the board. And I want to talk with you this morning a little bit about idolatrous worship generally, but in particular, I want to talk with you about Baal worship and what might have been so attractive about that. But they began to cease in their opposition to these things and dabble with it. And God was unhappy with them because they had not driven the people out as they had committed themselves to do. The time came when God would no longer help. And they continued then to participate in the idolatrous worship of the neighbors in whose land they lived. All right? We'll come back to that in a little bit. Here's where I want to be. The cycle, 15 judges, 300 years. There's the circle. I put a circle in there. And then here's the period of time that Randy has described, a period of being faithful to God for a while, And then they engaged in the idolatrous worship of the nations round about them. God raised up a nation, an oppressor, as it were, and the people cried out for a deliverer, and then they would be faithful to God for a while. Now, you would like to think that it wouldn't take you 15 times around the horn to learn this lesson with these judges, but it did. And we want to study that in some detail and see why and what happened and what was so appealing about these things that caused them to want to worship these idols. Now, Randy, you mentioned another generation. Open your Bible to Judges chapter 2. Judges chapter 2. In Judges chapter 2, read for me, if you would please, Randy, verses 6 through verse 11. 6 through 11. They didn't know. They didn't know. Yes, through verse 10, we'll get the point. They didn't know. And so we've got a generation on the scene that is not worshiping God, obviously have not been taught, and the consequences that have been proposed time and time and time again, generations before, are now to come to pass upon them. Back up, if you would please, Randy, in chapter 2, and begin at verse 1, and read for me, if you will, down through verse 5. All right, here's what's coming. You didn't drive them out. And so consequently, here's what's to happen. Not news, is it? God has told them this all along. Now, the first oppression came from Mesopotamia for 8 years. But if you'll drop down in the text to Judges chapter 3, in verse 8, it says, "Therefore the anger of Jehovah was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the land of Cushan." Richard, would you pronounce that for me, please? Thank you very much. King of Mesopotamia. And the children of Israel served that man, it tells us, 8 years. 8 years. They're worshiping idols. Not long after they've come into the land, they're worshiping Balaam. Interestingly enough, Baal was the name of the supreme God worshipped in ancient Canaan and Phoenicia. The practice of Baal worship infiltrated Jewish religious life during the time of the Judges, and you see that as early as verse 11 there in chapter 2, as they did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah and served the Balaam. It became widespread in Israel, especially during the time of King Ahab. You remember the contest on Mount Carmel, where Elijah the prophet challenged the prophets of Baal to call fire out of heaven and to consume their altar. That's interesting, because the supreme god Baal was known to be the god of thunder, or some referred to him as the god of thunder, which would indicate that he had the power to do this. Now, there is a generic use of the term Baal, not necessarily implying a god of thunder or a god of something specific, but a generic use of that term to indicate the patron god of various places. But according to the Canaanite mythology, Baal was the son of the chief god, and Asherah was the goddess of the sea. And he, of course, was considered the most powerful of all gods. And so this contest on Mount Carmel in the days of the prophet Elijah becomes quite a significant contest. If Baal be God, serve him. If Jehovah be God, then serve him. Now, going back in history to the time of Moses, Moses had warned them against worshiping the Canaanites' gods, Deuteronomy chapter 6, specifically the Canaanites' gods. But they turned their own way and did as they pleased, and now here we see the consequences to ensue. In Judges chapter 3, the first of the judges, Othniel, to deliver these people from the oppression of the king of Mesopotamia. If you'll drop down in the text, you'll note that there's no real description of a war that ensued. But it simply tells us in verse 9, when the children of Israel cried unto Jehovah, Jehovah raised up a Savior to the children of Israel who saved them, even Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, and the Spirit of Jehovah came upon him, and he judged Israel and went out to war, and Jehovah delivered Cushan-Rishathaim, say that one more time, Richard, please. Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand. We don't have a description of the battle that ensued, simply the deliverance. And here's the map that shows us the land and the oppressor of the kings of the Mesopotamian area, or the king of Mesopotamia, up here to the north. Any questions or comments just here? There's one thing that I think is quite fascinating is how quickly on the heels of this, in verse 12, what happened? Oh, you did? Nothing happened. Well, I'll push that button back. I didn't see you. I'm sorry. That's right. Yeah, and remain there for that very purpose. That's right. Very good observation. So it became a thorn in their side for this 300, little over plus years. Okay? As you turn the page there in the third chapter, in verse 12, it says, the children of Israel again did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, and Jehovah strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah. And he gathered unto him the children of Ammon and Amalek, and he went and smote Israel, and they possessed the city of palm trees. And the children of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. You might, in your reading of the book of Judges, I find it quite fascinating to note when it is said that this judge died, then here's what they did. It seems that their faithfulness to God after the deliverance didn't last very much longer than the life of the deliverer or the judge. And how would you explain that? All right. And that became a pattern. Very good. Bruce?
Yeah.
what they wanted to, yes. Mm-hmm. Ehud, the judge. I get those turned around too, Richard. Ehud was the judge. Eglon was the king. Those two, I don't know why. I get them reversed, I suppose. I struggled with that. But here's Moab down here to the south, and they have presented this problem. Of course, he incorporates the Amalekites into this effort, as well as the Ammonites. And then, of course, we have the period of Ehud's deliverance of these people. In chapter 3, there in verse 15, he's named. And what did he do to deliver these people? You really don't read of a war taking place either with this deliverance. What did he do? He killed the king. That's right. And, of course, pardon me? Okay, 10,000 Moabites. But he killed the king. He initiated a war, but he killed the king. And that took care of the essence of the problem. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel. The land had rest for 80 years. Interesting, isn't it? Well, I think that was described in chapter 1, beginning in verse 7. Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings, having their thumbs and their great toes cut off, gathered their food under my table, as I have done. So God hath requited me, and they brought him to Jerusalem, and there he died. I think the discussion of that is referenced here in chapter 1. No, Ehud, verse 17 says he offered tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. That's the text you're referencing, chapter 3, verse 17. Yeah, I wanted to talk about his size. He was a very fat man, the text tells us. Now, when Ehud killed Eglon, the text tells us that he used a sword to do it. And the sword was about the length of a cubit. Typically, a cubit is measured from the tip of your finger to the elbow. I was talking with someone just recently about that, and they said, well, that wouldn't always be the same. No, well, but it would average about 18 inches, is what we're told. So the sword that Ehud used to kill Eglon was about 18 inches long. And when Ehud thrust it into Eglon, the fat king, it came out the other side. But the fat encompassed the hilt of the knife. So that was how the text describes very vividly of how he was slain. All right, so we've got a period of peace that lasted for about 80 years. Well, the text tells us 80 years, 26 through verse 30, the victory is given to the Israelites. Now, in verse 31 of chapter 3, it says, and after him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who smote of the Philistines 600 men with an ox goad, and he also saved Israel. And the children of Israel again did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah when Ehud was dead. And Jehovah sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of the Canaanites. It tells us he reigned in Hazor. And his captain was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth of the Canaanites. And the text tells us in verse 3 that the children of Israel cried unto Jehovah, for he had 900 chariots of iron. And 20 years he mightily oppressed the children of Israel. Now, here again we go around the horn with the king of the Canaanites. Now, the king of the Canaanites, we don't read a great deal about him per se, but we do read about Sisera. And what was it then that Sisera did, who was the judge? Deborah was the judge. And of course, we see the area in which this conquest had to be established. The king of the Canaanites. Why do you suppose he wanted this area? Trade. Got the trade routes. And of course, numerous valleys through this portion. And we've talked about the way of the sea, how that it comes up here and then branches off. And the way of Shur comes up here and branches off and comes this way. And so, a very important commercial area. Now, in order to deliver the Israelites from the Canaanites, we read of Deborah the prophetess who participated in this. She gives instructions unto Barak to go and fight with Sisera. What was his response to that? Didn't really want to. I'll go if you go with me. All right. Well, tell me the story. What happened to Sisera? What happened to Sisera? Sisera thought that he had established an ally. And he thought that he could run to his ally's house and find safety. But he didn't find what he expected. Melissa? Nailed him to the ground. Now, when Barak came, what did he find? Already dead. All right, so that's right. Exactly the point. He had been delivered into the hand of the woman. And that was what Deborah told him in verse 9 of chapter 4. Because of your reluctance to go, you'll not really be the victor then. That's how that panned out. And so that was the end then of Sisera, and essentially the fifth chapter tells us the Song of Deborah, some great lessons involved in that. But at the conclusion of chapter 31, we learn that they had rest then for 40 years. What happened during the 40 years? Talked about that. What happened in the 40 years? The end of the 40 years. What always happens? The cycle. We're back to it again. At the end of 40 years, chapter 6, verse 1 says, "And the children of Israel did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, and Jehovah delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years." The hand of Midian. I want to pass beyond that. Sir? Yeah. They engaged in idolatry. Yeah. That's what any idol does. Yeah, that's idolatry. You do what you want to. And so I think the general statement, they did that which was evil in the sight of Jehovah, idolatry. They can do as they please and worship the gods of the people who inhabit the land. True. That's right. You do as you please. Yeah. 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 And that's a study in and of itself. You know, if we wanted to talk about the various objects of man's worship over the years, you'll find some similarities between them and the things that we read concerning the condition of the Israelites, the things that we read in Romans chapter 1, for example, the things that we read that characterize the New Testament cities of Corinth and Ephesus and so forth. It's all the same. You do what you want to, and you'll always find gross immoral practices where you find idolatry. And why do you suppose that's so? The very basis of things that we think about as the passions of humanity, that's what you find them doing, because you can do what you want to. Doesn't really matter. Just pick an idol. Boils down to love of self. Now, when you look in the sixth chapter and you see them doing that which is evil, and they're delivered into the hand of Midian for 7 years, look at the condition of the people. Verse 2, chapter 6, verse 2. It says, "And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel because of Midian," "the children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. And so it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites and the children of the east, they came up against them, and they encamped against them and destroyed the increase of the earth till thou come unto Gaza and left no sustenance in Israel, neither sheep nor ox nor ass. For they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came in as locusts for multitude. Both they and their camels were without number, and they came into the land to destroy it. And Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the children of Israel cried unto Jehovah." Now, there's a pattern involved in this. It tells us that God delivered them into the hand of Midian for 7 years. Now, we understand this principle of sowing and harvesting and the time or the passing of the seasons. And I find it fascinating that they would go into the field, they would sow, they would prepare the soil, sow the seed, they would take care of the crop in time of harvest. Here would come the Midianites and the Amalekites, and they would take it. And what happens next year? You prepare the field, you prepare the soil and get it all ready, you sow the seed, you raise the crop, and then in time of harvest, what happens? Here comes the Midianites and the Amalekites, and they come in and take it. Well, what do you think is going to happen to you over a period of time? You're going to be getting hungry. And the text tells us that they made for themselves dens in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. They're hiding. They're hiding whatever grain they can have to live, because they're afraid of the Midianites and the Amalekites. Yes. Yeah, yeah, they did it this year, this year, this year, this year, this year, this year, and then next year they did that again. And when you see that happen year after year, you're going to become discouraged. And the people did. And we might raise the question, why did it take so long for the people to cry unto God? You suppose they've been talking to their idols? Go think about that. You see, here come the Midianites and the Amalekites, and they come in, it tells us, as locusts for a multitude. What are you going to do to protect yourself against a multitude like that, Richard? Oh, sure, pray to your idols. Yeah, they'll take care of you. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, not anything he can do. He can't protect us. And if you look at verse 7 of the text, it came to pass when the children of Israel cried unto Jehovah because of Midian, that Jehovah sent a prophet unto the children of Israel, and he said unto them, "Thus saith Jehovah the God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt, and brought you forth out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of all that oppressed you, and drove them out from before you, and gave you their land. And I said unto you, I am Jehovah your God. Ye shall not fear the gods of the Amorites, in whose land ye dwell. But ye have not hearkened unto my voice." Do you read words that say, "I told you so," any clearer than the words that are found here? In verse 11, "And the angel of Jehovah came and sat under the oak which was in Ophrah, that pertained to Joash the Abrazite, and his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the wine press to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel of Jehovah appeared unto him and said unto him, Jehovah is with thee, thou mighty man of valor. And Gideon said unto him, O my Lord, if Jehovah is with us, why then is all this befallen us? You find that to be an interesting question. What's so interesting about it? Isn't that so? Yeah, I wonder why. And where are all his wondrous works which our fathers told us of, saying, did not Jehovah bring us up from Egypt? But now Jehovah hath cast us off and delivered us into the hand of Midian. And Jehovah looked upon him and said, go in this thy might and save Israel from the hand of Midian. Have not I sent thee? Now, I want you to pause and ponder that for just a moment. It appears on the surface that Gideon is kind of being disrespectful. You see that? Where is the Lord? We've heard all about the great things that the Lord has done for us. But he hasn't done anything for us now. Why not?
Indeed.
Isn't that so? Isn't that so? You see, the Lord had not been with the people. And why had he not been with the people? There was a condition attached to that, wasn't there? Oh, yes. Go back over there to chapter 2, where God had addressed them and told them, here's what I said to you, but you didn't hearken to my voice. Verse 2. Do you see that? There's a problem here. The problem is not God. It's not God's ability. The people have not discharged the responsibility that was imposed upon them that they agreed to. Bruce? All right, we've got it going around the horn again. And now Gideon is going to be the one to do that. Look, if you will, at verse 15 now of chapter 6. It says, and he said unto him, O Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is the poorest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. And Jehovah said unto him, surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man. I want to talk some more about Gideon, but notice again the assurance that God will be with him. I'll be with you. That's what God had promised. But again, that's conditioned. Go do what I've told you. Richard? That's right. That's right. It would appear that Gideon has heard about God, but as far as any upbringing to worship God, highly questionable. And so, yes, therein lies a great deal of the problem. Well, while we're in Judges chapter 6 and chapter 7, we perhaps need to describe the Midianites, who they were. They were a nomadic people from the desert, these nomadic tribes, made their living by caravan trade up and down the trade routes, commerce. And of course, if they can time that just right, where they take everything that Israel has, then they can make themselves quite wealthy, and Israel has nothing. Now, in this story, we learn that they came up the king's highway, crossed the Jordan near the ford at the ford near the Jabbok River, stole the crops from the tribes in the central portion of the land. 7 years this occurred, and if we look back at our map, we see that it went all the way to the sea, to the city of Gaza, so that Israel had virtually nothing. Now, we've learned in the reading that Gideon was of the tribe of Manasseh. You'll see that there. And the Midianites had camped in the valley of Jezreel to to take those things that the Israelites had. Now, Gideon calls his army from Asher, Zebulun, Manasseh, and Naphtali. And you see why. The army was to come from the surrounding area. And how many does he have in his army? Well, let's go, if you would please, to the 7th chapter. But before I do that, indulge me just a moment. Richard has brought up the text of verses 25 and following regarding perhaps the upbringing that Gideon has had. But we also want to comment on his faith in God, or should we say lack thereof. When you back up further in the text to verse 19, Gideon is told by the angel of the Lord to prepare, it tells us, a kid and unleavened cakes of an ephah of meal. He was to put it in a basket, and he brought the broth in a pot. And the angel of God, in verse 20, said unto him, take the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and lay them upon this rock, and pour out the broth. And he did so. Then the angel of Jehovah put forth the end of the staff that was in his hand, and touched the flesh and the unleavened cakes. And there went up fire out of the rock, and consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes. And the angel of Jehovah departed out of his sight. Now what is it that Gideon saw? It tells us in verse 22 that he saw the angel of Jehovah face to face. Does that change Gideon? Ah, I wonder why. Well, let's read on just a little bit. In verse 35, it says that he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, and they also were gathered together after him. And he sent messengers unto Asher, and unto Zebulun, and unto Naphtali, and they came to meet him. He's called in his army together. But then in verse 36, Gideon said unto God, if thou wilt save Israel by my hand, as thou hast spoken, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there be dew on the fleece only, and it be dry upon all the ground, then shall I know that thou wilt save Israel by my hand, as thou hast spoken. All right, God, here's the deal. I want to see another sign. I'm going to lay out the fleece of wool. And if everywhere around it is dry and the fleece of wool is wet, then I'll know that you're going to do what you said you would do. What happened in the morning? Just what he said. That's right. He wrung the water out of the wool, and all around it was dry. And then he said, let's do this one more time. I don't want to make you mad, God, but I'll speak this only one more time. Let now be dry only upon the fleece, and upon all the ground let there be dew. What'd God do? All right, the fleece was dry, and there was dew round about. Now, is Gideon convinced? He saw an angel of the Lord. It took more than that. He called his army together, but he's still not ready to march. Got to put you to the test, God. Let's let this fleece of wool be wet, and then, of course, let it be dry. And after these two miracles, then maybe we can do something. Forgive me for seeming a bit reluctant to be enthused about Gideon's willingness to do this. When you look at the first part of the 7th chapter, Gideon is called Jerubbaal, or Jerubbaal, who, and in verse 2, God said to Gideon, the people that are with you are too many. What's the problem? Gideon's got his army together. How are the Midianites described? Like locusts. You've seen those pictures. We've seen them before in previous studies. So the answer is, anybody that's afraid, what do you do with them? Go home. How many went home? How many are left? How many did he have starting out, mathematicians? 32,000 people. All right. All right. Would you take 32,000 more if you could get them? But he sent 22,000 home. Now he has 10,000 remaining. God said, yet too many people. He said, take them down to the water, and I will try them there. Let's see how they drink. If they drink this way, you set them aside. If they drink this way, you send them home. Now Gideon's army whittled down to how many? 300 people. Why did God whittle his army down so small? All right, you'll see that in verse 20. The people are too many, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me. Was there ever a danger of the people of God becoming so arrogant that they believed the deliverance was their own? Oh, yes. We've talked about this before as we talked about the Assyrians when they conquered Israel. How that the king of Assyria credited himself with all of the victories that he had gained. And then the Babylonian king, King Nebuchadnezzar. And what was it that he had to learn? That God rules in the kingdoms of men. And of course, it necessitated him becoming a madman until he learned that. Now, Israel had to get that. That God has provided this deliverance. So with 300 men, in verse 9, the text tells us, it came to pass the same night that Jehovah said unto him, arise and get thee down into the camp, for I have delivered it into thy hand. Look at verse 12. The Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along in the valley like locusts for multitude, and their camels were without number, as the sand which is upon the seashore for multitude. And when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man telling a dream unto his fellow. Now, in all of this, Gideon seems convinced that he can do what God has told him to do. Now, I'm out of time, but I want to pick up on this in our next study and talk about the plan of God. How that Gideon takes these few men, 300 men, and he puts in their hand a pitcher, a torch, and a trumpet. And with these implements, the Midianites are put to flight. How much time do I have? I'm so tempted to. That's not much time. The point that Gideon makes is, look on me and do what I do. Follow my leadership. We're going to follow a lesson on leadership as we talk about that. We're going to see how that every man stood in his place. We'll talk about the importance of fellowship, if you please, and how that the plan of God worked and the Midianites were indeed put to flight when they submitted to this plan of God. All right.